This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, May 11th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from Northwest Arkansas's Earth Day Festival. This 40-day festival continues through Monday, May 14th at a variety of locations with events, parties, and learning opportunities. The Eco Passport, a detailed calendar of events, and more are available on the web at earthdaynwa.com.
Later on this edition of Ozarks, a Berryville man is kayaking his way down the mighty Mississippi. He'll talk to us by cell phone as he gets closer to New Orleans.
And the legacy of Maud Dunlap Duncan. She led what is believed to be the first all-woman city government in the country when she was the mayor of Winslow. Remembering a small Ozarks town history is just ahead.
First, Governor Mike Beebe says even though revenue collections for the state have increased in recent months, no modification to the state's budget are expected.
Right now, we're not increasing the forecast for the year that starts July 1st. That's too far off. I'd rather be conservative about it. It's easier to be conservative and go and then fully fund unfunded portions later if the money comes in than it is to go the other way and try to fund something when the money's not there and have to cut.
This week, the governor's office increased its revenue forecast by almost $40 million for the final 2 months of the current fiscal year. That will allow funding of second-tier items and $10 million to be placed into a rainy day fund.
Northwest Arkansas Community College is entering into preliminary talks that may lead to the purchase of land in Springdale for a Washington County Instructional Center. Yesterday, the school's land use committee voted to recommend the school's board of trustees enter into talks regarding land in Springdale owned by Philip Taldo, adjacent to the home of the Northwest Arkansas Naturals. Dr. Stephen Gates, the senior vice president for learning and provost for the college, says Washington County residents make up a big portion of the school's enrollment.
About 38 to 40% of our student enrollment has Washington County addresses, and we are also in Washington County now at two locations. One is our small center that we lease over on Elm Street that's really at capacity. And also we have a presence in the Jones Family Center over on the east side of town.
Northwest Arkansas Community College officials have been studying possible sites for a permanent Washington County presence for about 18 months. We'll have more about this story on the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large, Sunday morning at 9.
Former presidential candidate Rick Santorum is scheduled to be in Northwest Arkansas tonight. The one-time U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania will deliver the keynote address for the Benton County Republican Party's Lincoln Day dinner at the Springdale Holiday Inn Convention Center. More than 400 people are expected to attend that dinner.
Arkansas's congressional delegation is asking the U.S. Department of Defense for documentation justifying the potential loss of the A-10 aircrafts at the 188th Fighter Wing in Fort Smith. Senator John Bozeman and other delegation members met with Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta yesterday to outline the reasons they believe the 188th shouldn't lose its 21 aircrafts.
As we, cut back significantly on defense, that we make sure that we're taking the time to do these things in an appropriate way and get the most bang for the buck.
Senator Bozeman says the 188th is possibly one of the most cost-effective bases in the country. He says deep cuts to the U.S. defense budget won't take effect until Congress approves the bill.
The Arkansas Razorback baseball team is now under 500 in SEC play after dropping an extra-inning game to Auburn last night in Fayetteville. The Tigers won 3-2 in 10 innings, dropping the Razorbacks to 12-13 in the conference. Teams play again tonight at 6:35 in Baum Stadium. And the Northwest Arkansas Naturals will meet the Springfield Cardinals again tonight at Arvest Ballpark after four Naturals pitchers combined on a no-hitter last night. The Nats won the game 2-0.
May is Arkansas Heritage Month, and many towns and cities are celebrating with events and exhibits showcasing the dreams and determinations of our hardworking forebears. The town of Winslow received a grant to highlight the life and successes of their most famous citizen. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas traveled there earlier this week and has this report.
If you're driving south on Old 71 and go west on 74 just past West Fork, after going up and down some lush green hills and around some curves framed with wildflowers, you will arrive at the town of Winslow. As you pull into town, a pavilion will be on your right. Straight ahead, just beyond the railroad tracks, is an old gray brick two-story building. It was once the general store. And to the left, a row of buildings, the kind that meet at their walls. It's here, in between City Hall in the Mercantile, that you will find the Winslow Museum. And inside is Miss Barbara Ashbow. Not quite a Winslow native. She's lived here just 40 years.
I was able to learn a lot of the history by memory from teaching, substitute teaching in Winslow School. And instead of doing the subject I was supposed to be doing, I would do Winslow history, which was easier for me, and the kids liked it better.
Miss Barbara helped start the museum in 2006 in what was once the Winslow Post Office and then the library. A book depository can be seen in the front window. Prior to the 1900s, Winslow was a stagecoach stop for lines running from Fayetteville to the River Valley. Timber quickly became a source of income.
This is a picture that shows one day the amount of wood that was ready to be shipped out. And they say that every Saturday, all three roads coming into downtown had wagons back as far as you could see hauling in what they had cut during the week.
The lumber was primarily used for fence posts and railroad ties. Incorporated in 1905, the town quickly became prosperous. The coming of the railroad further opened the area to the outside world, and due to the high elevation, there were cooler temperatures in the summer, making it a popular spot for vacationers.
And as I said, there were six large hotels here that were full all the summers. People had homes here from as far away as Chicago, Galveston, Texas. Lots of people from various places in Texas. Of course, a lot of people from Fort Smith. And the men commuted on those. So it was just a wonderful history.
Though the population has remained steady at 400 inhabitants, the town is in a decline, one that began in the 1930s.
At one time, we had a health center, health clinic here, and Washington Regional said it wasn't profitable, so they got rid of it, which was a big blow, too, because we had worked for several years doing everything we could to make money to establish the clinic. We had a doctor here for 8 years.
Another loss was the closing of the high school in 2005. But it was during the town's heyday that Winslow's most famous citizen, Maud Dunlap Duncan, first arrived.
She came here when she was 14 in 1887, and she taught area schools for a few years, and then she helped her foster father in his drugstore. He was a doctor.
She learned the druggist trade, traveling to Hot Springs to take the registered test, becoming the second female pharmacist in Arkansas in 1906. Maud married in 1908.
And her husband started a newspaper and built a two-story drugstore, two-story over in this area where we are now. And he printed a little newspaper called the Winslow American upstairs, and she had the drugstore downstairs. And he passed away in 1918 from the flu epidemic, or pneumonia, I believe it was. And she continued to try to publish the newspaper and work in the drugstore.
Eventually selling the drugstore so she could focus on other endeavors, such as becoming mayor of Winslow.
And in 1925, a group of Winslow women got together and decided they'd run for city government, which, you know, they'd only had the right to vote since 1920. And so that was a real big deal. And the men got together and decided they would elect them just for the heck of it, and that they knew they weren't going to be successful and they'd make a mess and then the men would take over again.
But they were successful, remaining in office for 2 years. As mayor, Maud got rid of the town's virtually unused jailhouse and made the area more accessible.
The road going out toward what is now 540 is an S-curve, and it was straight up. So the old Model Ts had to back up it. They couldn't go forward because the gas ran back and it wouldn't get to the carburetor. And so they changed the road alignment.
This petticoat government, as it was called, was the first in Arkansas and one of the first in the United States. Newspaper men came from all over to interview them. In a special exhibit, the museum has articles from the Chicago Delphinium Monthly, the Des Moines Register, and a copy of one from a New York paper. After her career in government, Maud focused on the paper, the Winslow American. She did it all, writing, typesetting, to running the press. The four-page weekly contained
local news, you know, Mayor so-and-so went to Fort Smith yesterday. But it's real interesting if you get into the history, those old newspapers, because you recognize names and you know who they were and so forth. So it gives you a lot of history on other people just to read the Winslow Americans.
The museum has a good selection, ranging from 1908 until the 1950s. Being the area's only newspaper woman also helped Maud gain national attention. The people who vacationed there would take stories of her back home. She published the paper literally until she was too frail to continue, never even increasing the price.
All of the years that it was published, from 1908 to 1953, is the last I know of that she published it. Every year was a dollar a year. And they were sent by mail to all over. Had a large subscription list. And bless her heart, that was her only income. That was before Social Security and any help. And so she really had a hard time.
Though she was facing destitution, Maud was prideful and wouldn't take handouts from anyone, only accepting a dinner invitation if she thought her company was wanted. She eventually went to a nursing home in Fayetteville, where she died 2 years later. While she is Winslow's most famous citizen, other things have put the town on the map. Three movies have been filmed here, including the 1993 film Frank and Jesse, with Rob Lowe and Randy Travis. And there are other people the museum would like to highlight, including a Civil War veteran who fought for the Confederacy, later becoming Winslow's Justice of the Peace, and conducting Maud Duncan's swearing-in when she became mayor. But it is clear that Maud Dunlap Duncan is special in this town, and to Miss Barbara.
This is a poem written by Lida Wynn Pace about Maud in 1927. The end of it, says, "And about the best booster there is to be found, well, she's worth heaps in our little town."
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
In addition to the special exhibit, the museum has developed living history dramas depicting various times in Maud Duncan's life. One will be performed tomorrow morning at 10 at the Pavilion in downtown Winslow. To see both dramas, head to Ozark Folkways Saturday the 19th at 2 o'clock. For more information, email winslow.museum@yahoo.com.
More than a month ago, Carroll County native Jason Ball embarked on a 30-day solo journey by kayak through the White River chain of lakes down the Mississippi to New Orleans, where he is expected to complete his journey today. But unlike his early American explorers, Jason had a cell phone. So Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich called him up to talk about his expedition as he was paddling 2 days north of the Crescent City.
For years, Jason Ball pursued urban exploration, that's crawling through underground and forbidden city sites and industrialized areas, which he's written about under his pseudonym DavidKeats.com. But on a rain-soaked April 7th, Jason Ball slid his wilderness tsunami kayak onto a tributary of the James River near where he lives in Springfield, Missouri, and headed south to spend a month alone paddling to the mouth of the Mississippi. His first encounter was with Table Rock, Taneycomo, and Bull Shoals Lakes, all large dammed impoundments requiring portage. Jason used his GPS device to navigate wide expanses of lake and the best portage routes. By the way, during the interview, Jason had to pause here and there to adjust his course.
It took me 2 days to get through the James River, and that took me down to the Table Rock Lake. Now, when I got to the Table Rock Lake, there's the big dam there, and there was a road that went around, and once I got all my stuff up to the top, one of the foremen actually offered to throw my kayak in the back of his truck and went around, and I had a very similar experience going around the dam near Mountain Home. But when on the White River, they do have those open spillway dams like you were talking about, the Corps of Engineers. And the first one was actually very difficult to get around. I got up to it, and I kind of went back and forth for about an hour to try to find a reasonable way to get around it.
Instead, he decided just to stop and make camp, and it was a good thing he did because the next day he had to crawl on all fours up a steep embankment, pulling his boat and gear after him. Eventually, he made it to the White River.
Oh, that was quite an experience going through the White River. The last week, it was it's a national wildlife preserve. So what happens is it kind of becomes a very swampy area to either side of the river, and I had a very difficult time finding camping sites. But every day, probably about 8 to 10 hours between each float, I would come across a sandbar that I could camp on. It. But then I came up and saw the lock from the White River going into the Mississippi River, and you know, it was very huge. I've never gone through one before. So it was just seeing this mammoth structure come up ahead of me after, you know, 2 weeks of floating through just wilderness area with nothing but swamps to either side, not even seeing people, was it was very awe-inspiring. And so I floated through the lock, big concrete walls on either side of me, and then I opened up and saw the Mississippi and realized that it was four or five times the size of the river I'd been floating in, but I was really excited.
On the mighty Mississippi, he quickly learned to avoid all sorts of new hazards, like gigantic river barges, their wakes, half-sunken tankers, and chunks of floating debris, not to mention the water.
Oh, it's bad. It's really muddy. When if the wind comes up and I get any kind of water splashes over my kayak, when it dries, you can see there's just sand everywhere. In fact, if I reach my hand in and I let the water seep through, I see little bits of sand, little grains of sand on my hand. So sand is just sand and mud and dirt have gotten into everything. Every night when I get in my tent, no matter how careful I am, when I get it set up, there's always sand and grit and things.
As compared to Ozarks water, right? And he had to contend with swarms of insects and deep mud getting off the river in certain places. No support team was on hand, but friends and family kept track of him, emailing weather warnings and other useful information. He's encountered a few storms, but mostly conditions have been pleasant. Except for only 3 nights spent in motels, he's camped out, sleeping under the stars, weather permitting. On the night of May 5th, Jason caught a very clear view of the supermoon, so-called as it came closest to Earth in its annual non-circular orbit.
Which is really cool. It's a very, very bright moon. And I was thinking, you know, how many people are looking at this, and it's speaking to them in a different way than it's speaking to me. And so when you talk to somebody about something, you think about, you know, how is this going to speak to you? How do I express what it says to me? And I've just been really thinking a lot about people's perception of things.
Jason also has seen lots of wildlife, deer, raccoon, flocks of eagles on the lakes, shorebirds along the rivers, snakes, and one alligator, which made him very, very nervous.
But the sun had just gone down, and I was on a sandbar. I looked over, and I saw it come out. There's kind of a little bayou area really close to where I was. And I saw it come out into the water, and all I could see was its eyes and its nose on the top of the water. And, you know, it was dark. I couldn't get a picture because the sun had gone down. But I saw it come out, and it kind of swam up toward me a little bit and then cut across the river, and I never saw it again. But that was the only one I've seen.
As he talked to us, Jason was 80 miles or so north of New Orleans.
When I am paddling, I usually get about 6 miles per hour. And the kayak that I've got, it's really nice. I've had it... The wind's picked up a few times where I've just been completely on my side with the water. So even if the cockpit were to fill with water, it's not going to sink. Before I left, I took it out in the lake and kind of tried to roll it, and it's double beveled on the bottom, so it actually has a lot of stability.
As far back as June, Jason began to plan for his adventure, including what he calls his river diet, apple cinnamon oatmeal and powdered milk with Bangkok, an instant powdered milk fry bread for breakfast, and lots of mac and cheese and instant grains for lunch and dinner, all prepared on a tiny cook stove, often seasoned, he said, with river sand. He supplements with power bars and peanut butter. He resupplies weekly, traipsing into nearby towns for fresh water, fruits, and vegetables, where friendly locals have offered him lifts. Normally, the 5'8", 27-year-old weighs around 150 pounds, but by journey's end, he's down to a skinny 135. And the first few days were really tough.
And I've got to paddle back out just a little ways. There we go. My wrists would become sore, and my shoulders hurt a little bit, but what happened was I got very, very used to it.
Lugging more than 100 pounds of gear has got to hurt. But overall, he said, he's in good shape, having spent months running and weight training to prepare. Being one of only a handful of people who annually paddle this route solo, Jason says he's gotten lots of looks from locals.
The people, they say I'm crazy. Either they say I'm crazy or they think it's just the coolest thing in the world.
When not exploring, Jason works full-time for Ark of the Ozarks, assisting dual-diagnosed mentally ill residents. But he saved up lots of vacation time to do this. And even though he's alone, he says he hasn't felt alone.
It's actually really neat. When I go by, I'll see dock workers, and they're usually really good to wave. And, some of them will give me a big thumbs up, and sometimes I may be going, someone's fishing, or I'm on the side of the bank, and they kind of ask me where I'm going. I tell them, so half the time the response I get is, "Good golly, why are you even wanting to do something like that?" And usually my response is that I don't even remember anymore.
Several weeks leading up to this trip, Jason wrote on his weblog that he had mixed emotions, worried he might not reach his destination or would be ill-prepared. So he reached out to other adventurers for advice. That helped. But he only has one regret.
Would be to bring an extra paddle.
But with that one single very lucky paddle, Jason expects to rendezvous with an Ozarks friend at a designated New Orleans dock.
I'm going to get picked up, and then I'm going to, there's a hostel in town. They said that I could store my kayak inside there. I'm going to get there, and we're going to go and get some shrimp po' boys and get up the next morning, grab some beignets, and then head back home.
And after more than a month of subsisting on powdered and instant meals, a Cajun feast seems a perfect way to celebrate a successful and inspiring solo voyage. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can trace Jason Ball's kayak journey at his website, davidkeetz.com. That's David, KEETZ.com.
The Bentonville Farmers Market is open 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. each Saturday morning and 10 to 2 on Wednesdays. Located in Lawrence Plaza, just north of the downtown square, this market offers fresh produce, meats, cheeses, breads, and coffees, as well as handmade crafts, cooking demonstrations, and live music. More information is available at downtownbentonville.org or 254-0254. And later on Ozarks at Large, how a 3,000-pound rocking wedge or an oversized hamster wheel can be integrated into dance.
So much of what we do is based on air awareness. It's such a unique skill to teach. I think students of gymnastics and any sort of athletics, especially parkour and free running, which has really, really become very interesting and kicked off with so much interest, as well as circus schools. Circus schools have been popping up all over the country, and so much that is taught is air awareness.
Chiza Yamaguchi, a member of Diavolo, discusses the performances the dance company will bring to Walton Arts Center tonight and tomorrow night, later on Ozarks at Large.
The farmers' markets are bustling throughout the region. A warmer-than-usual winter has produced some market staples earlier than normal. Blueberry lovers should take note. And at a half-dozen Northwest Arkansas markets, a new program is underway allowing SNAP recipients an incentive to shop locally. SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, is designed to help people with low incomes get healthy food. To explain the latest news about local food, from what's at the markets to the new program with SNAP, we invited our local food ambassador, Teresa Maurer, to come back to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. And with her was Heather Frederick, a program technician in the Horticulture Department at the University of Arkansas, to help explain the new $2-for-$1 program for SNAP customers.
We have received a grant from the Walmart Northwest Arkansas Giving Foundation. And when I say we, it's the University of Arkansas and the Northwest Arkansas Farmers Market Alliance. to develop this program so SNAP participants can, when they shop at the farmers market, get double their dollars for local produce and plants. So when they go and, say, for example, swipe their card for $10 or $20 at the market manager table, they will get that tokens that was that's a dollar for dollar match on that.
It's easier to encourage people to eat healthier and locally, especially if your dollar's going to go twice as far.
Yeah, exactly.
How does it work? Once you get the tokens, do you just go to the vendor?
Yes, you can go to the vendor, and the vendors they display a sign that says they take EBT tokens or SNAP tokens, and then basically they're in $1 denominations. We can't give change, so usually the vendors are pricing things in whole dollar amounts, and then the vendors in turn those into the managers, and we turn that back into cash. But it's a really easy thing for the SNAP recipients to keep track of, and they can come back the next day and swipe again for $20 next time the market is open, at least at Fayetteville, and we'll match another up to $20. And we do our matching. Now, each market is going to be different, but in Fayetteville, we ask people if they want to do the match to come on a Tuesday or Thursday market to get their tokens, but those tokens are good all season. So they can, once they get them, they can spend them at any market.
Any Fayetteville market,
right. And then each of the other markets has got a similar program. And in addition, there's a program that allows them to buy food-producing plants. So if they have a garden and they want to grow some of their own food, they can use the tokens for that as well.
What markets are included in the alliance?
There are seven markets that are participating in the Local Food Double Dollars program for SNAP. There's Fayetteville, Bentonville, Springdale, Rogers, Eureka Springs, and Siloam Springs. And one more, the Madison County Market, Farmers Market, which is in Huntsville. It's really a win-win because the customers, they get to spread their dollars even farther, but it's for the farmers as well and the local food economy. We're just infusing those dollars into the local economy as well. So
yes, and it's nice because people's eyes just light up. I mean, I've had single moms walk up with kids, and sometimes they don't know about the double dollars, and they just light up. And in some cases, get very emotional about it. And then when we tell them they can spend it for food or plants, a few of them said, oh, I'd really like to have a garden or a little container on my apartment patio or whatever. It's just been very rewarding.
The Sunday market is rolling now in Fayetteville, right?
It is. Yeah, we had our opening day. The Fayetteville Farmers Market also exists at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks on Crossover Road. And if you don't know where that is, we've got a little flyer at the Square Market that shows you, and you can also go online, the Fayetteville Farmers Market website. But this is a Fayetteville Farmers Market, just in a different location. It operates a little bit later on Sunday. It starts at 9, and it still runs till 2 o'clock. We had 25 vendors there last week. It's set up in a meadow just south of the main botanical gardens. It's kind of on city property, and the botanical gardens kind of helps us and lets us use their part of their facilities. And it's set up in a nice little circle in the meadow. So you can go from cut flowers, there's a bread seller there, there are the produce vendors, and we had quite a few art vendors because of last week being an art and craft weekend. And we will have some of the same art and craft vendors this weekend because of Mother's Day falling on Sunday. So it's just a great market. It's a different atmosphere because you're surrounded by trees and you get off the hustle and bustle of 265 and you just step into this gorgeous meadow. And we'd really like people to come out for that. It's a very nice setting. It's a market that we're trying to promote and develop, and it will run through October.
Okay.
So 9 until 2, and you can look at FayettevilleFarmersMarket.org if you forget those hours or need to know exactly where the market is.
If you have any confusion about where farmers markets are or what restaurants serve or what farms grow locally produced food, you have the update available for us as well, don't you?
I do. I'm holding in my hand this beautiful color guide. It's called Local Food Guide for Northwest Arkansas, the 2012 edition. And Kyle remembers last year when I talked about this, it was a black ink on ivory colored paper, 8 pages long. This year it's full color, 16 pages. We got some sponsorships from the Fayetteville Farmers Market Market, downtown Bentonville, Feed Fayetteville, and Ozark Natural Foods. And it was just miraculous because we raised just enough money to print 5,000 copies. That's the amount of sponsorships that came in. So that guide has information about all the markets in Northwest Arkansas and whether they do this SNAP program or the senior vouchers. And in June, the WIC program. There's also a WIC program connected with markets as well. It lists individual farms and restaurants and community-supported agriculture, which is a shares program where you can buy a share of produce and meats. And we've got these cool little business cards, you know, in case we run out of the pretty color guide. And on the back, there's a QR code that will take you right to the site. And we're also asking people out there to help us grow the guide. And that is if you know of a farmer or you have a restaurant and you locally source your food, you know, you can get online and enter that in. And we may not be able to do another print guide for a while, but we will be updating the electronic version. So I'm just really thrilled. This came together because of generous volunteers with their time and sponsors, and we're busy running them all over the Four County area.
And let's see, the last couple of weeks have been good for radishes.
They have been good for radishes, but now, Kyle, it's berries. Today, raspberries at the market for the first time. Tuesday, blueberries at the market. We do have a number of vendors of berries, and we're going to try to spread those among all the four markets, including the Botanical Garden Market. And come early and get your berries and check out all the other great things there are right now at the market.
Teresa, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kyle.
Heather, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Heather Frederick is a program technician in the Horticulture Department at the University of Arkansas. Teresa Maurer is the local food ambassador for Ozarks at Large.
150 years ago, Confederate Colonel William L. Jeffers' Independent Cavalry Command was reported camped at Chalk Bluff on the St. Francis River in northeast Arkansas, operating against Unionists in the area. Colonel Edward Daniels of the 1st Wisconsin Cavalry saw Jeffers as a threat to his troops at Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and mounted an expedition against him. Arriving at Chalk Bluff on May 15, 1862, two privates swam across the St. Francis and seized the ferry boat, which the Yankees used to transport their men to Arkansas, trading fire with Jeffers' Confederates the entire time. The Union cavalrymen, fighting dismounted, drove the rebels from the field. The 1st Wisconsin suffered 3 killed and 6 wounded, while the Confederates lost 11 killed and 17 injured in the first of many skirmishes that would be fought at Chalk Bluff during the Civil War. To learn more about Arkansas history and the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, visit ArkansasCivilWar150.com. The Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. I'm Mark Crist.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Yitzhak Grajeda.
Antoinette, I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
If I said you were going to see a dance performance tonight on the stage at a local venue, what image pops in your head?
Ballerinas.
Okay. What if I told you you were going to see a giant rolling metal wheel or a more than a ton rocking wooden wedge or one of those, you know, Plinko that's on Price is Right, one of those, but it's oversized and there are people falling down it instead of chips? What would you think then?
Sounds like a circus.
It's kind of the combination that's going to happen tonight.
Oh.
The dance troupe Diavolo will be on stage tonight and tomorrow night at Walton Art Center. And Chiza Yamaguchi, who is a member of the dance company, came to our studio yesterday. Now, let me ask you another question.
Mm-hmm.
If I told you someone was a professional dancer and they were touring throughout the world with a dance company, mm-hmm. you would think they started dancing when?
Probably started taking ballet when they were 3.
Again, something of a surprise, because Chiza says she didn't decide to pursue dance until late in her college days at UCLA.
Yes, very late in my college career, which is a wonderful surprise for my mother. I discovered dance, specifically dance, in college at UCLA. In my junior year, I was studying Japanese language and literature for, I still don't know why, I guess just because of my heritage. But yeah, took an elective class. I think it was something very random, Tai Chi or flamenco, and you just know when the spark hits and the passion starts bubbling up and it's undeniable. And finding Diavolo coming out of college, I know for a lot of people they've already had previous training and they just add on to the training that they had. I discovered Diavolo and realized I will train for this company specifically and fingers and toes crossed I will get in. But making that sort of commitment and almost doctrine with yourself of I'm going to make it into this company no matter what it takes. And that's exactly what happened. But yeah, so much of my training was motivated by the aesthetic of the company and the interest in the work.
When you say you discovered Diablo, how did you discover them?
Great question. So at UCLA, when I started taking elective classes and dance courses, alumni of the company at the time were getting their master's degrees there. And one of the requirements in that department is for master's candidates to teach in their style. And so they taught an upside down workshop, and which was so fascinating as a dancer. I'm like, oh, the world of being upside down and inverted and learning partner work and learning almost stunt parkour-esque work. And they fueled me in the direction of take an intensive with Diablo. We used to be members of the company. They're based here in Los Angeles. They have summer intensives and winter intensives. So 3 months into discovering dance, I thought it would be a brilliant idea to take an intensive. And I was definitely handed quite an answer. But it was just the beginning of my training and understanding what steps I needed to take and how far along I needed to go in order to achieve what I was contemplating.
I'm glad you brought up upside down, because it's hard on radio sometimes to explain what Diablo does.
Mm.
But this is a company that could have, understandably, an upside down course, an upside down workshop. What happens in that? You're upside down?
So much of what we do is based on air awareness. It's such a unique skill to teach. I think students of gymnastics and any sort of athletics, especially parkour and free running, which has really, really become very interesting and kicked off with so much interest, as well as circus schools. Circus schools have been popping up all over the country, and so much that is taught is air awareness. And it's so hard to describe until you start getting on a trapeze or until you start taking a class in handstands and learning what does the body look like and feel like upside down. What does it look like in the air when you really can't see and determine, oh, this is what we want. This is the look that we're trying to achieve. And so much of Diablo is just us training with one another. We don't have mirrors at our studio. So every time we create pieces, we watch one another and we pick and choose what fits with the themes that we're working with and what also is pleasing to the eye. And sometimes we're like, well, that looks really great, but I think it would look even better if you jumped into it or someone caught you out of it or you spun into it. And so we start taking these very basic ideas of being upside down or doing simple partner work and elevating it, whether let's do it on a rocking structure or let's do it on a structure on wheels. How can you do the same thing while something's moving or your surface is now suddenly going from horizontal to vertical? So it's just really interesting to be able to play with those dynamics.
Some of the things that you dance with, around and on, there's this wedge that goes to and fro. It's going back and forth and gaining momentum. People literally fly off of it.
Yes.
Spring off of it. There's this giant hamster wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And people are doing things on it as it's rolling around.
Yeah.
Has there ever been something brought out that any of you were like, you know what? This just doesn't look like a good idea.
That's such a funny question, because I think we've all had that moment of arriving into rehearsal. First day, you're the rookie. Mm. And we have so many exercises of being drivers and passengers and knowing when you're new to the work that you're sort of a passenger in a sense, not really a follower, but you're taking notes and you're taking direction, and seeing these set pieces is incredibly intimidating. I will never lie and say, oh, yeah, I was made for this. I was born to do this. Absolutely not. But that's the thrill of it. It really has you rethink what your instincts are. On the set pieces, the more you fight against them or the more that you try to intellectualize or analyze how things are working is usually when things go awry or the wheel will run over your foot or something silly like that. So when your instincts start kicking in and really having a new understanding of if I rock with the structure, I'll actually be able to stay balanced as opposed to fighting against it. And trusting sort of the inner animal, I think something that we like to do as dancers, I never imagined dancing on a wheel and powering it like a hamster wheel or moving on a rocking structure and doing exactly what I do on a regular stage that doesn't move.
Now, you spent part of the past few hours here working with students, right?
Yeah.
What do you do when you work with students?
Oh, what do we do? Funny that you should ask. I've had the pleasure of being the education director for the company for a few seasons now. and really fine-tuning our curriculum. So when we do workshops in the communities, we've worked with a multitude of students here in the community. We went to McNair Middle School, and we went to St. Joseph's Catholic School as well. And then we got to work with the Walton Arts Center staff. So we had just a full range of students. But we usually take them through day one of Diavolo. It's the same workshop that we actually run with new members that come into the company. They're very based in trust and teamwork. As spectacular as the work is with structures and set pieces and architecture and how we bridge dance with that, Diavolo is very much based in trust and teamwork. Nothing that we do on stage is able to be achieved unless we trust one another, and we understand that we can't achieve any of that unless we collaborate and we create together and we fail together and we succeed with one another.
Now that I've met you and we've heard you, what can we see you do tonight and tomorrow night during the performances if we're looking for you?
Ah!
What
oh, my gosh. It's so, oh, well, I can't really speak for myself. The pieces that we'll be performing are all group pieces, mm-hmm. which is so dynamic for us. I think something that was really special that someone brought up to us, having recently worked with, I work with Cirque du Soleil. I'm one of their yoga instructors on the new show that's playing at the Kodak Theater in Los Angeles. It's a very unique experience seeing Diavolo because we are not specialty acts. We don't have one person that's a contortionist
right.
and someone that does trapeze, and you come on for 8 minutes and then you're done and you can get out of costume and you have the rest of the night off. Our group pieces include all 10 dancers at all times. We never leave the stage. So it really becomes such an epic journey for each of us to get through the half hour of each piece and seeing how the group dynamic is. I would just say, look out for as much as you can possibly see because there's so much going on. I'm still discovering things in each of the pieces. When I'm behind a set piece or I'm on the side of stage, I don't really even understand what goes on half the time either, so it's always a thrill for me to find new elements. So I encourage the audience to keep your eyes open, scan the entire stage, because you're going to find special moments, even if they're very subtle. Sometimes those are the most memorable.
Chisa, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Chisa Yamaguchi is a member of the Diavolo Dance Company and the company's education coordinator. Diavolo will perform tonight and tomorrow night at 8 at Walton Arts Center as part of both the venue's Artisphere and 10x10 series. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Pete Hartman, Operations Director for KUAF. Welcome back.
Hello.
The Metropolitan Opera season has ended.
It has ended. It ended last Saturday.
Which means?
Which means we're going to roll out, kind of going to do something a little different over the next 5 to 6 months during that slot, Saturday, at least at noon. Now, what our listeners have gotten accustomed to when the opera season was not going on would be, wait, don't tell me at noon.
Mm-hmm.
We also heard that again Sunday at noon. Well, since we were doing that, we thought this is a really good opportunity to highlight some of these special programming that NPR has started to roll out.
And these are programs that wouldn't go through the whole year. They're just limited series.
That's correct. And so you've got to think these are programs that our listeners would not hear, weren't hearing them before. They'll hear them now. We should first say, wait, don't tell me is not going away. It's still Sunday at noon.
Right.
And we think that's
where
the
it's
best.
Been for years.
Exactly. That's where it was initially. So, exactly. The first special series, which we will begin this Saturday at noon, is called the TED Radio Hour. I didn't know much about this at all. All I knew was it was the capital T, capital E, capital D, and I knew I had seen that before. So when Rick gave this to me, he said, hey, take a look at this. I knew it was now time for me to understand what this capital TED is. And I looked into it, and you know what you and I have kind of talked about it. Technology, education, design. Technology, education, design. And it's just a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, and new ways to think and create. Basically, what I've listened to a few of these programs is it's an hour of people talking about stuff.
Hmm. Now, what happens is you get some of these creative minds. Michael Pollan, who was just here within the last – he first sort of got sort of his fame through TED Talks. If you're given a limited amount of time, you don't talk for the full hour. You'll hear someone and they have 8 to 15 minutes to get the idea across. So they really have to think about it.
Well, what little I've listened to the first program, which we will hear this Saturday at noon, it really seems like it's going to fit very well into that set, what we've got going on Saturdays. So that's the TED Radio Hour. This is a special series that NPR put together. It's going to run about 10 weeks or so. Then, of course, listeners, if you may be you may know our Saturday lineup that is outside of the opera window, and that will be followed by Snap Judgment.
Which we started last year.
That's right. I still consider that a newish program. Snap Judgment, that's an hour-long program. How would you describe that?
I think it's
Definitely an art program, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
That's art and concepts connected by different concepts. It owes a little bit to This American Life, but it would be unfair to say it is an American Life-esque show.
And you've got to think, rolling out of that TED, that just fits perfectly, kind of that flow. So that's 1 to 2 is the program Snap Judgment. Then at 2, we feature All Songs Considered, a very popular program from NPR. That's a half-hour program, so it ends at 2:30. And that's when we will begin again with our continuing series of Tales from the South. This is a program from KUAR in Little Rock, which we began last year. Is that correct, I think?
Yes, I think so.
And it features people, many of them with Arkansas connections, telling stories, true stories, from a stage at the Starving Artist Cafe in North Little Rock.
Yeah. And it really has – it's a half hour, so I think this lends itself – it has that feel of within minutes, you feel like you're there. You're part of this crowd listening to these speakers and these authors and these readers. And so this of course, the first one we'll hear Saturday has got the title of Mother's Day. So it must be chock full of stories. Of course, that's Sunday. So that gives us a little idea of what's going to happen at least in the next 10 weeks. Now, again, specifically talking about that noon to 1 hour. As I said, that's a 10-week, this TED Radio Hour, 10-week special. After it's run, we'll have another 10-week special from NPR. This is called Ask Me Another, and they call it NPR's exciting new show featuring puzzles, word games, and trivia played in front of a live audience. And I got to tell you, I have a feeling our audiences, our listeners, are love that program. So that will we will begin airing that after the TED Radio Hour series is done airing. Then after Ask Me Another is we're done with that series, we're going to begin another one called Cabinet of Wonders. Now, this is so new, there's very little information out there. Even NPR has not even rolled
out
too much.
So that hasn't even
started. Not even started. I don't even think they've even recorded these yet.
Okay.
But that's well on. So those three sets of special series on Saturdays should take us up to the beginning of the next opera season, which is December 8th. So some really neat programs coming up in the next 5 months or so on Saturdays on KUAF.
Antoinette's least favorite thing just happened.
What?
We bounced like 6 months into the future.
Yeah.
That makes you feel very uneasy, doesn't it?
It does.
She likes to stay in the moment?
Yes.
Well,
okay.
Very much.
I'm sorry.
It's
right.
Okay.
So the new Saturday lineup begins tomorrow at noon.
That's right. And real quickly, Kyle, I did want to mention one other thing. We have a newish jazz program on Saturday nights at 10. Now, a lot of our longtime listeners will say, whoa, that's Mary McPartland's piano jazz slot. Well, it's called Piano Jazz Rising Stars, again hosted by John Weber. It is a 13-week series, and what it does is highlights the jazz legends of tomorrow and follows winning combination of talk and music, which many of our listeners are already aware of. It sounds a lot like Marion McPartland's piano jazz, but with some of these younger stars, we already heard this series that already started. It actually started last Saturday. We heard from Taylor Ixty, who has come through this area. This weekend show features saxophonist, vocalist Grace Kelly. Later on, we'll listen to the Thelonious Monk competition winner, pianist Chris Bowers. So a really neat program that Saturday nights at 10, Piano Jazz Rising Stars. Just a few programs that we're wanted to highlight here on Ozarks at Large.
Pete Hartman is Operations Director at KUAF. You can hear the brand-new Saturday lineup tomorrow beginning at noon on KUAF. If you'd like to see the schedules for KUAF as well as KUAF 2 and KUAF 3, you can go online to KUAF.com. Support for KUAF comes from Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, hosting the Hudson River School, Nature and the American Vision, featuring landscape paintings depicting a time of exploration and growth in American history. This exhibition, organized by the New York Historical Society, will be on view through September 3rd. Timed reserve tickets are available online at crystalbridges.org or 418-5700. KUAF is supported by Westwood Gardens, celebrating Mother's Day with hanging baskets, garden gifts, and blooming roses at four locations in Northwest Arkansas. 442-3500 or westwoodgardens.com.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Winslow.
Winslow.
Yep.
High atop the Boston Mountains.
Yep.
Plans for the weekend?
Yeah. I think when we get done here, we can go see if there are any tickets left to Diavolo. That is the worst part. I think if there's a bad part about this job is we get all these people that come through here to tell us about their art form,
mm-hmm.
and then I want to go see everything, but I don't
have
time.
So it breaks the bank account and you don't
have
time.
It breaks the bank account and I don't have time, but I think I would like this try this one out. I mean, they're 10 by 10, so.
Right. So most tickets are $10. I think this would be one that would be ideal for the balcony because there's so much going on.
That's true.
And I think you'd want to see a lot of it
right.
as much as possible in one
view.
Right.
Without having to turn your head and stuff. So,
yes.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. And then tomorrow I'm going to the Demolition Derby in Springdale. I'm pretty excited. I've never been.
It's been a long time since I've been to a Demolition Derby.
I kind of want to drive the car. I mean, I know they won't let me tomorrow, but I'm just saying.
You were saying you were a budding Demolition
Perhaps.
Derby driver?
Perhaps.
You know, years ago I did a story on a father-son combination.
Really?
And they said it was a lot of fun.
I think it could be fun. I mean,
last week while I was gone, you took a sledgehammer to a car.
Yes.
Right? It's part of the university de-stressify thing
yeah,
that students were doing.
Yeah, their UA finals car smash. Yeah, so, you know, that's like on the way. It's like baby steps or something, right?
Note to self, don't let Antoinette drive my car.
Just saying. What about you? Are you going to be busy?
I think so, but I don't know doing just what yet.
Do you have a forum?
Thank you.
Right?
I do know that Sunday.
Let me help them out.
Yes, thank you. Sunday afternoon, across the street at the Fayetteville Public Library, a forum about Theater 2's new play festival.
Mm-hmm, which is next weekend.
Right. But as a kickoff, I'll be moderating a forum with some of the playwrights that are involved. That's Sunday afternoon at 2, absolutely free, at the Fayetteville Public Library.
There you go. See, you have something to do.
I do. One other note, thoughts and prayers with a member of the extended Ozarks at Large family, Becca Martin Brown, whose husband Larry passed away this week.
Yes. We love you, Becca, and anything we can do for you, just let us know.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Have a pleasant weekend.